This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tan Talk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And we really do have to appreciate our area here in Clearwater. It is always so wonderful and so beautiful. 2 weeks ago when I went up to New York City, I arrived and it was 44 degrees. And I understand it was 58 degrees this morning. So we are very lucky to be right here in Florida in this beautiful weather that we have. I also wanted to say that I am looking forward to the Tan Talk Radio celebration of D-Day here on June 6th. Big Ed in the control room, you did a great job with that announcement. Thank you. My father was, of course, in D-Day, and he received a Silver Star, and there's so many memories of that that I want to share too on my program, but it's going to be here. The big program will be right here on Tan Talk on June 6th. And thinking of fathers, there is, you know, I always like to look for books that one should give to one's father or male friends in the family, and it's so funny. A month ago, I bought a book. Now, everybody knows I don't buy that many books anymore. I spent years buying books, thousands and thousands of books. And then I started Joy on Paper, and I didn't have to buy books because people send them to me, and publishers send me boxes of books to select. So it's very funny, and the next guest should feel very honored that I actually paid for his book because I saw it, and I said, I have to read it. And the book is called Henry Himself, and it's by Stuart Onan. Hi, Stuart.
Patsy.
Wow. I am so happy to talk to you because, as I said, it's so funny. You know, I don't have to buy books anymore. But when I saw this is the third of the story of the Maxwell family, I was so excited to get this book. I just had to buy it the minute I saw it.
Are you an Emily fan?
Oh, absolutely. I remember, when Wish You Were Here was the first of the your books. That was back in early 2000s, right?
2001, yeah.
Yeah, because there were so many things familiar for me. It's very, you know, our family, we had a lake house. And so many of the things in your story are very familiar to me, even the fact that I grew up in a place called Highland Park, Michigan, which is very similar to the Highland Park in your story. And so and of course, as I said, my father was in World War II, he was there at D-Day. And so your story about Henry Maxwell is so touching, and I just feel very comfortable reading the story. I feel like, you know, I know Henry, and the special nature of these people, the guys who went through World War II, were really very special.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's the, you know, the highest praise, that you know the character. That was my hope, that by the end of Henry's book, that we would all know him as well as he knows himself.
And you achieved it. You know, of course, this is a prequel to the prequel. You become prequel king. For people who haven't read the other two books, I want to tell them they can start right off with Henry himself. They can just read the other books later on, because it is really a perfect gift for Father's Day. I think there are so many people who will enjoy this book, men and women, who will just gravitate to this book. And once they start reading it, what you've achieved, this feeling that we know these people, we want to know more about them, and we just follow along with the story. And of course, it helps that you have one of the most beautiful covers. This cover, isn't it wonderful?
Yeah, they did a wonderful job, and I think they were trying to match it a little bit to the Emily cover. They need to be companions.
And they did, but this one is particular. Just to see Henry walking with Rufus, wow. It took my breath away, because immediately I knew, you know, even just from the cover, I knew what the story was going to be. It was going to be just a joy. You know, when I talk about joy on paper, one of the joys is when you step into a book and you feel so comfortable and feel so comfortable both with the writer, that the writer is going to do a service to the character that you are now, you know, invested in.
Well, that's my job. I'm always there in service of the character. It's never about me. It's about, you know, finding out what it feels like to be these people. And that's what sort of fascinated me about first Emily. I Wish You Were Here is going to be all about her. And then I found Arlene, and then I found Margaret and Kenny and Henry and the whole family, and everybody became really interested in me. So I just kept trying to, you know, figure out who are these people and how do they feel about each other? Because that's what drama is, right? It's how we feel about each other, you know, and how we treat each other. And so when I finished Wish You Were Here, I realized I really hadn't written Emily's whole story. And I felt kind of bad about that, because it was supposed to be about her. And 8 years later, I just started thinking about her and coming back to her and saying, you know, what's she up to now? How's she getting along? And when I looked back in on her, I found this sort of fascinating story between her and Arlene. And then I had a chance to write just about Emily. And in doing so, and then in taking the book out on tour, I found out that everybody has an Emily. Now, whether it's a sister or an aunt or a mother or a grandmother or a cousin, everybody has one. And I want to believe that's true of Henry, too.
Oh, I think it is. And when I was really so thrilled that you did Henry, because, you know, having gotten into Emily and really cared about her and always wondering, there's always this, what was Henry like? Because what I love when I was reading the book, in so many ways I found similarities with my own father, because he was stoic. He didn't talk about the war years, and he was although my mother died when I was young, I had a stepmother, and he was exactly the same way. He was very diplomatic, very with her, you know. She would have ideas, and he would just like go with the flow. But you know, there were so many things I just said, yes, this is the right way. This is the right way to go with this character.
Oh, thanks. Well, I think he and, you know, a lot of the fathers and husbands from mid-century America are a bit mysterious, because they held their secrets very, very close, and they weren't effusive. They weren't sort of wide open. And how do you write about a person like that from the inside? You know, what does he really feel about his war years? Does he share them or not? How does he feel about the children? How do they feel about him? In the first two books, we have the view of Henry from all these different characters, but it's always from the outside. And it's a bit like that parable about the elephant and the blind man, right? Everybody has a very, very different Henry. But who exactly was he? And I had to really come up with that. And boy, it took me a long time. But I came across the very first sentence. It took me a while to get there. But the first sentence is, his mother named him Henry after her older brother, a chaplain killed in the Great War, as if he might take his place. And right there, I said, wow, that's the bar for Henry. You know, he has to be as good as the older brother, a chaplain, who was killed in the war. How do you do that from the time that you're a child until, you know, you're fully grown, and even in old age, and you say, how well did I do?
Well, now, of course, you dedicated this book to your father and your grandfather. So some of this was sort of imbued in you too, the character of Henry.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. I am Henry. I am also Emily too. So you know, Fitzgerald said that, you know, to write a character, he needs an emotion that he can understand. And I think I can understand the emotions that, that both Emily and Henry have. They certainly come from me and from my family. I wanted to write books that were about the things and the people closest to us, that mean the most to us, and that always comes down to family.
Now, when I was reading it, and I'm thinking, my father never talked about the war. It was only very, very late in life that I could get anything out of him. And as I said, he got a Silver Star. So he had to do something pretty good, right?
He went through it, yeah.
Yeah, and going through D-Day and all of that, but he never talked about it. And this is what I felt also, with Henry, they don't talk about it. And I kept saying to myself, okay, I since you're getting to be really good at prequels, maybe we'll someday find Henry when he was in the war. But all of this is in your head. When you wrote the first one, did you already have this background of Henry in your head, or it came out after all those years?
I'm going to say some of it was there. There were hints, there were clues. And when I started to write the draft of the book, I went back to Wish You Were Here, and I read it and looked for any mention of Henry. I reread Emily Alone and looked for any mention of Henry to figure out what clues are pointing me where. But in writing Henry itself and writing the draft, it was still a process of discovery and finding out. And that question, who is this guy, was with me all the way through the draft process. And by the end of it, I think I answered pretty well. I mean, even if his own family doesn't know him as well as they could, because he doesn't let them, I think the reader knows him pretty well.
And it is true, these men, particularly the ones who went through World War II, and we call them the Greatest Generation, and partly it is because they just persevered. They got back from the war, and they started a life and tried to make it as good as they could for their family. Perhaps it was because they saw so much ugliness that they wanted their families not to have to face that.
Yeah, and again, these were things that were expected, right? I mean, what are the privileges, but also the responsibilities, the obligations of the mid-century American man? That's one of the bigger, larger societal questions I came in with that I had to answer. And Henry is supposed to get married. Henry's supposed to start a family. Henry's supposed to get a good job and be the breadwinner. And this is the way things are supposed to be in that time and place. And now it's 1998, and a lot of that is now in the past. And society has changed completely. He's a little bit bewildered by it, and he realizes his time has rather passed.
Well, in a way, it reflects a little bit of your life. I mean, you started off as becoming an engineer, which is not, it was a completely different lifestyle.
Yeah. Well, and my father was an engineer. His father was an engineer, and I was really good at math, and I grew up during the moonshot, the Apollo series. So it seemed natural for me to go into aerospace, and I had a great time, a great career, great job, wonderful job. But I've always been a huge reader, and I guess I got the bug, because I would come home and I'd write short stories in my basement after work. And I was in test engineering, so it was when we were on, it was 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, and yet I would still find time to get down in that basement, put some hours into my writing. And my wife said, look, you're not paying any attention to the kids or to me or to the house. And all you do is go to your job and come home and write. You should really try to write for a living. And I was like, wow, you're crazy, because I was making good money there. But she believed in me and sort of pushed me to go and try it. And it took a while, but, I got there.
You did. You certainly did, because I think it was your second book you finally got an agent?
It was my second published book, but it was probably about my fifth book. there's always a bunch of books you have to put in the drawer.
And, that's always, my listeners always, we have to find an agent. And it's not easy, You know, so when that happened, when you finally find an agent, boy, it must have been an exciting moment for you.
Well, I mean, you think, you know, once you get the agent that everything's going to be smooth sailing and that they'll drive, right? That they'll drive the bus now. And my agent loved the book that I had shown him. And he tried to sell it for, I want to say, 3 years. He came very close at FSG. We did revisions for them, and eventually they just said no. And in the meantime, I'd written several other books, and they'd won awards and competitions, things like that. And so in the end, my first agent, never sold a word that I wrote. I moved on from him and had to go get another agent. But it was sad because nice guy, great guy, wonderful person, wonderful reader, but he got sort of stuck on this book that I was writing, and he couldn't let it go. And sometimes you have to let some of those early books go. It's a shame, but, you know, I still had a great time writing that book. I still believe in that book. I still believe in the characters. I can still see the characters. But for the marketplace, maybe it wasn't right.
Well, I think that's a good thing for authors to hear, that, you know, you went through the struggle, and now you certainly made it, because you are so popular, and your books...
Oh, well, that's very kind.
You know, and when you have the fame that you're now getting, partly because of these three books, but also for some of your other work, it just helps you to just keep going, to have this knowledge that you've got it now, and that you can keep writing and make a living.
Well, you can the job is still the same. You still have to sit down, and you still have to sort of discover something and come up with something that will connect somehow with readers and make them feel for the characters. And, you know, you're capable of writing a bad book, you know, every time out. You know, and every day you write badly. That's what I tell my students. You write badly, and you should give yourself the license to write badly, because that's what it's about. You know, it's about every day making it a little bit better and a little bit better and a little bit better. It doesn't come out wonderful. Usually it comes out pretty bad. Even after, you know, all the struggle of a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, you can finish a book and it can still be terrible. There's no author out there that wrote nothing but good books. It just isn't.
Well, certainly Henry himself is, I think it's a great book. And I think that it would, it was funny, a week after I paid for the book, I get a note from your publicist who says, "Do you want to promote a really great book for Father's Day?" And I looked at it, and it was Henry himself. I said, "Okay, well, you know, I just paid for that book, but it was worth it. It was worth it."
Yeah, you can give that book to someone to give to their father for Father's Day.
Well, yeah, I will. I will give a couple other copies. I already am ordering some to give to one of the things I like to do. I give books to the VA, and I think that this book will also, I think a lot of the vets will enjoy this book.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
And, of course, it is, one of the things I wanted to mention, one of the things I like, they don't do, a lot of people don't put, like, any chapter headings in books anymore. And I like that you have that.
Yeah, I think it helps frame the little stories. Every little piece has its own sort of beginning, middle, and end, and usually has a little bit of a moral or a parable or even a paradox to it. And I think the title helps frame that.
I did. I got a kick out of some. Well, I out of the stories, and then and seeing them, because for people who are like reading the stories, and sometimes particularly I think people reading on Kindles. They remember, you know, I want to go back and read that story again. And with this ability here, with the titles, I thought that was really nice. Like Honeydew, you can go back to.
that confused my German translator. He was like, "Honeydew, what does that mean?" Because, of course, you know, they don't have the word honeydew, so they can't think of the honeydew list. But I had to explain it to him. Like, God knows how he's going to translate.
Yeah. How would you do it in German?
Well, it's probably a word like 15 syllables long and has lots of K's and V's in it.
Well, by the way, how many languages have your books been translated into? Lots.
Oh, lots. Well, remember, I did a book with Stephen King about the Red Sox.
Oh,
when you're riding with the king, you're everywhere.
Oh, that's for sure. That's for sure. Well, we're going to talk about that book because I think that was very clever of you to get involved with Stephen King. It's always good to get involved with Stephen King. And also about your teaching, we might even mention one of the books that I really like. I like all your books, but the one that I different from this series is A Prayer for the Dying. So we might talk about that too.
That's a very strange book. Wow,
it is completely different from your other writing, I think. So we'll come back. I have to take a quick commercial break. And if you'll hold on, we'll be back. We'll talk about your teaching and about a lot of things. Okay?
Thanks, Patsy.
Okay, hold on.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my guest, Stuart Onan, and we've been talking about his wonderful new book called Henry Himself, which is a perfect gift for Father's Day. Hi, Stuart.
Hey, Patsy.
Okay, well, as I said, I think this is a wonderful gift, and anyone who reads this book will also, I think, want to read your other books that tell the story of the Maxwell family, and they are Emily Alone, which is about Henry's wife, and of course, Wish You Were Here, which is I got into that book because it brought so many memories back about our you know, house on the lake. It's a very touching book, and I hope that everybody will just. It's real easy. Onan is real easy. O'NAN, a nice name to remember, easy to remember. And you can find it, you know, wherever books are sold. And I think you just start off with Henry, and then I think everybody will want to go backwards.
Well, it's very funny because you mentioned, you said Emily is Henry's wife. I've never heard her mentioned that way because she's always Emily, and Henry is always Emily's husband. So it's kind of neat.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating story and one that I think people will really enjoy. And wow, you know, you are one of the things I want to mention about this book is, well, and the three books particularly, there is a, there's a calmness in these books, and one feels that you are sure of the words as you're writing them. I don't know how many times you had to rewrite it to get it that perfect, but there's a, one feels comfortable, you know, like an old shoe, you know, comfortable. You step into it and you say, I'm here and I can just go along at my own pace and enjoy the process.
Well, I mean, part of that, I think, comes with, you know, knowing the characters so well. For me, I've been writing about these characters for 20 years now. And for readers, especially readers that started with Wish You Were Here, they know these characters very well. So coming back and being able to spend time with Emily, or with Emily and Rufus, or with Henry, or, you know, even, you know, their children, you know them. And once they step on stage, you already have a feel for them.
It is. It's like they're your neighbors, and you feel for them. Now,
well, that's another thing. They are very much like the people we know. I mean, they are people in our family. They are our neighbors. There's nothing sort of extraordinary or magical or, you know, extreme about them. They're just regular people.
But what makes a great writer is he can take the ordinary and make it extraordinary, and you certainly have done that.
Well, thanks.
Now, let's talk. We mentioned earlier about Stephen King, and this is so funny. I thought how you got involved with Stephen King is an interesting story that you should share with my listeners.
Well, back in the 90s, I wrote a sort of a wild satirical road novel, and I titled it Dear Stephen King. And this was to sort of tip off the reader that this was not sort of a sort of my usual sort of heartfelt, domestic, working class American fiction. This was going to be kind of wacky. His lawyers out in Hollywood heard about it, because it started to kick around as a film project. And they were not pleased. They were not happy at all. And so they kind of leaned on Doubleday and on my agent at the time and said, hey, you know, this, you know, you do this, we're going to take you to court. So, of course, I tried to appeal directly to the man himself as a writer, one writer to another. And from that appeal, we just started emailing back and forth and talking. And one day when I was writing, my wife said, hey, there's a guy on the phone for you, a guy named Steve. And I was like, huh. So I answered, and it was Stephen King. He said, hey, how'd you like to go to the Red Sox game tonight? And I was like, you bet. I'd love to. you know, and we sat down at the Sox game, and we found out we have such a shared background, our love for writers like Shirley Jackson, Richard Matheson, the early Ray Bradbury, Richard Matheson, Charles Beaumont.
Dennis Johnson?
For the Twilight Zone. Dennis Johnson a little bit, but I'm talking more about like the great 50s and maybe early 60s writers. Horror, and we love the Big Bug films.
Ooh, I love the Big Bug films.
Yeah, you know, all that stuff, all the creepy stuff.
I terrified my brother, my little brother. I took him to see The Tarantula. Oh, my gosh. He's never recovered, actually. He has never recovered.
How old was he?
He was like 4 years old.
Oh, my God. I can see that.
Yeah.
By the time you're 8 or 9, you're like, yeah, Tarantula. Okay.
Yeah.
But and we also had a great love of rock and roll and punk rock and just all the sort of the sort of teenage sensibilities that we had, I guess, and a great love for the Red Sox, who, you know, at the time when we first met, we're not doing so well. So later on in 2003, when they started to really challenge the Yankees, when the new management came in, we wrote a blog, myself, Steve, his son Joe Hill, and his other son Owen King. We all, the four of us, wrote this blog down the stretch to talk about how excited we were about the Red Sox finally challenging. And so when spring rolled around, my editor Doubleday, who was a huge Yankee fan, said, hey, how'd you like to write a book about the Red Sox? Because, I mean, it's you know, now or never, right? New manager, they just got Curt Schilling, they finally got a closer. You know, and I was like, yeah, you know, I'm not, you know, not a great, great sports writing kind of guy, but I'll write it if I can write it with Stephen King. And of course, my editor's like, well, of course, that would be great.
Yeah.
And at the time, Steve was finishing up the Dark Tower series and was very busy, and said, well, you know, I'm kind of busy. I'd rather, you know, not. And I said, look, you know, I'll write 90% of it. You write 10% of it. And it'll be Stuart Onan with Stephen King in small letters. And he said, okay, let's do that. And, but you know Stephen King. Once he gets involved, he's going to be involved all the way. And he writes so fluently, so quickly and so well. And his mind works completely different from the way my mind works, the way that it organizes stories and things like that. So every day we wrote about the Red Sox throughout that season, and we'd have my story and his story, and then I'd sort of, you know, mold them together or choose which one I thought was better there. And by the end, it was pretty much 50-50. And it was going to be a book about why the Red Sox, who were the most disappointing franchise in, you know, Major League history, had the most rabid fans. You know, the most faithful fans, the fans that would come out and fill up that stadium night after night after night. And we were going to answer that. And then the Red Sox went and beat the Yankees and won the World Series and kind of ruined the entire theme of my book. but the idea was to follow the team and see how our emotions change, you know, from day to day, from win to crushing loss. And our expectations and our hopes, because that's what being a fan is about.
Oh, yeah.
It's about not being able to control your emotions. You know, as you're going through the season, baseball season's a long season.
Oh, gosh. I am a Tigers fan. I mentioned
sorry.
I was. Yes, thank you for that.
Hey, we'll always have 1984. Right?
I grew up, you know, in Highland Park, Michigan, and just outside, it's part of Detroit. And my father, because he was in the Teamsters, used to get tickets for the game, and so we sat behind first base. And I love baseball. I'm a real baseball nut, and Tigers. I'm still faithful after all these years, and I.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's,
you know.
You know, a team should go up and down. They shouldn't always, like right now with the Red Sox and the Yankees and the Dodgers, Cubs. You know, every year they're expected to win it. You know, that's not how baseball should work. You know, for a while you should be up and then you should go back down and then sort of rebuild, reload, come back up. You know, I'd like to see that more, but I don't know. When teams like the Red Sox are spending, you know, $275 million on their payroll, and how do you compete with that?
Yeah, it's different from the old days, that's for sure.
And I'm a native Pittsburgher and Pirate fan. And, you know, our team is just, you know, our season's basically over in March. And that's tough.
Well, you know, so you got that book with Stephen. And then what happened? What happened?
Well, we did the book, and after that, a few years, well, with Steve, you're sitting there, and you're watching, say, the Red Sox with him, and you're hanging out with him, and he'll turn to you and you say, hey, here's a story idea, and he'll give you a great story idea. And you'd be like, wait a second, you know, I'm in the middle of a novel, I can't write that. But one day he came up with this idea, he said, hey, here's an idea. You're watching the Red Sox on TV, and you look behind home plate, and there you see somebody that you know from your childhood that you know is dead. You know that person is dead, but there they are in the crowd. And he said, go home and write that story. And, of course, yeah, I didn't. But about 5 years later, I woke up in the middle of the night, and I had the story in my mind. I was like, oh, my gosh, this is how the story goes. And so I, like, you know, sometimes when you wake up in the morning, that thought seems just dumb and stupid. But when I woke up, I was like, you know, that actually worked. So I emailed Stephen and said, hey, I think I got it. And he goes, hey, that's great. You write the first five, I'll write the next five, and we'll just go from there and see what happens. And so I got to collaborate with him on that book. Well, it's an e-book. It's called A Face in the Crowd, and it's set right there in Tampa.
I know.
Tampa, St. Pete.
Well, as I said, it's so funny because being a baseball fanatic, I read anything to do with baseball, and so I was so thrilled with this story. And it for years, I've been thinking about a story about something happening at first base. The reason we like first base is, when I was a kid, my biggest thrill was to see somebody steal.
Yeah.
Base stealing. There's nothing so exciting as that. And, you know, at first base, you watch them, and you know they're good when they want to take off, and you get so excited. I love that feeling.
Yeah. And, well, for the story, I mean, for years, Steve has called the Tropicana Dome the Trop. He calls it the Creepy Dome. And for a while, he had, I think he may still have season tickets down there because he lives down there half the year. And so we figured that would be the exact right place for it and to have the game between, I think it's the Sox and the Rays, because of that disparity. So it makes sense. Our main character is from New England. Now he's living down there and he goes to see the Red Sox. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fun read. I enjoy it, and it's, as you said, it's an e-book. It's called A Face in the Crowd. It's a novella, and anybody who loves baseball will enjoy it, and anybody who loves just sort of little strange story, I think it's a great read.
It's very much a Twilight Zone story in the mode of Richard Matheson, or of even Ray Bradbury. And when we started writing it, I had those two writers in mind.
Well, I love it. I think it's a great story. So I was so thrilled when it came out. Wow. So you have a really a diverse range. Tell us about teaching. You know, one of the things looking at some of the advice that you give to your students, and I like that... one of the things that you suggested is to keep the manuscript with you. So often people don't keep the manuscript with them when they're, they just don't keep it.
Right, and that you can get separated from it, and you need to stay connected to the characters. And I always tell them, actors, I have a friend who's an actor, and when he's working on a part, he always keeps the script with him so that if he has, a moment, just like, if he's stuck on one side of the street before the light changes, he can take a quick look at the lines. Stay connected. Stay with that character. The more that you can think and daydream about that character, even in a sort of distracted way during the day, something good might come in because of it. But when you completely separate from the character and the character is not in your mind at all, you're not getting any work done. I also recommend taking that character out into the world with you, wearing the mask of that character. So, say I'm writing about Emily. If I go to the grocery store, I want to try to see the grocery store the way that Emily would see it rather than the way that I would see it. Get into her mindset. And if you're in her mindset, you might see something that then you can use and put into the book that somehow connects with her. And it just deepens character, I think.
Now, you teach all the time? It's sporadic?
No, very little. I've been teaching the last few years, last, say, 10, 15 years, at the Writers in Paradise Conference over there at Eckerd College in St. Pete.
Mm-hmm.
So big, big shout-out to them over there. Les Standifords over there and Sterling Watson. Dennis Lehane was one of the founders of the program. Laura Lipman is there all the time. Ann Hood, Andre DeBuse, third. Really good crowd over there. And great students. Our students are starting to publish and win awards. It's exciting.
What are like some of the first exercises that you give students to do? They come to you already. They already want to be writers. They're trying to be writers. So what's the first step that you try to get them on the road to being a better writer?
Well, maybe not exercises, but just in workshop, just going over their manuscripts and seeing where their strengths are, and their weaknesses as well. Jane Smiley says that usually an author has something that they want the reader to see as their center of interest. That is why we should be interested in this particular, story. And we try to sort of tease that out. The different writers around the table say, well, I thought this was interesting, or I think this is what the author wants us to be interested in, here's why I'm interested in it, or here's why I'm not as interested in it as I could be. And that's a larger issue. And usually that's true, I think. I mean, the larger issues are the ones that stop us from reading, not the small stuff. We can usually get over the small stuff. And I try to tell them that there's a certain line in writing, a certain level, that if you can achieve that level, the reader's going to be fine with it. And I call that the Danielle Steele line. If you can write a sentence or a scene as well as Danielle Steele can, the reader's going to be fine with it. We don't all have to be Virginia Woolf. We don't all have to be Stephen Milhauser or Toni Morrison or John Edgar Wideman. Just getting the basic nuts and bolts of it very plain and getting the character through scenes. I also tell them, you know, forget about the sentence. You know, the sentence is not the basic building block of drama. And forget about the right word, you know, le mot juste, the Flaubertian thing. Yeah, that's great for some people, but basically what we read for are scenes. We want to see characters coming in conflict with each other within scenes. Put your major characters in conflict right in front of us. We want to see it live. Don't give me a big backstory. Don't give me, you know, a big, you know, memory break there. Let's see it happen live right in front of us. We've all grown up with television and movies. We're used to that. So stick with that.
And write your own sentences, please, people. I'm getting quite a few authors who are getting obsessed with these writing programs that give you options on words, and I'm starting to recognize them when I get a book. You know, I see they're using some kind of grammar program that's fixing their grammar. And I, you know, can you imagine James Joyce putting his book through?
I've never heard of it. That's very strange.
Oh yeah, it's happening because they come up with the same word. So if you write a sentence that you know has a sentence that's just a ordinary sentence. I really like that girl. Well, they'll come up with options for liked, and they'll come up with options for girl, and they'll come up.
I see. What they call the elegant variation.
Yes,
right?
And I've been seeing that, and since I get the same thing, I'm like, please, people, don't use those grammar correction things, because, well, can you imagine if we put think of some
well,
of the.
I mean, in looking at Emily Dickinson's manuscript, she did basically the same thing. Some of her unfinished poems have, like, they'll have a word, and then she'll come up with three or four words that could be there. She just stacks them up right on top of that word.
Oh, that's one thing if you are thinking of the words. It's one thing if you're thinking of the words, but if the grammar program every time picks up the same three words, and then...
Well, I mean, typically for me, there just aren't enough words. So I'll get to a place where I need a certain word, and I'll say, oh, that word's just a little bit off. It doesn't have quite the right flavor to it. And I'll go to the thesaurus, which I guess is the old person's version of that program. And I'll be leafing through the thesaurus, and I won't be able to find exactly the word that I want. And it just doesn't exist in English. And I'll be like, what do I do? You know, and I'll have to find, I'll have to settle for the word that is the close enough approximation. But that's, again, that goes back to that idea of Flaubert and le mot juste. And yes, it does affect the reading and the reader's experience there, but it's not the most important thing. There are two great American writers who are great writers despite having the debilitating problem of not being able to write a decent sentence: Theodore Dreiser and Philip K. Dick. I mean, these two guys could not write a sentence to get out of a paper bag, but they're still brilliant writers. It's not necessarily the surface, the material, so much as the dream that the surface can evoke. And I want to say, when I was reading Ha Jin's very first story collection, Under the Red Flag, which came out about 20 years ago, I was just blown away by how good it was. He was writing in English as a second or third language, and it was very crunchy, but the stories came through, the characters came through, the wisdom came through, the feeling came through. And most of us have read Chekhov, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Flaubert, Sartre, only in translation. And some of those translations are really bumpy. You know, if you go back and you reread your Chekhov, you know, those Constance Garnett translations are really crunchy, and yet it still all comes through. It's still incredibly moving. And that's really what we want as readers. We want to be moved. Sure, it's nice to be dazzled by somebody like Virginia Woolf or, say, Joyce at his finest. But finally, we'd rather be moved by what the characters are going through. And that has very little to do with the surface.
And I think it is also important for authors to try to try different styles and different subjects. Sometimes people will get, you know, they're just writing cozy mysteries or they're just writing thrillers. But I think it is great when they try something else and try another style, a whole different field. And of course, you've done nonfiction, which I think, like with Stephen King, is great. And then you've done a book like A Prayer for the Dying, which is, I think, very different from some of your other work.
Oh, that's just a strange, strange, weird gothic horror book set in 1873, I think it is, 1871 on the Wisconsin frontier back then. Yeah, very odd. It's a siege book. It's a plague book. It's an overtly religious book, which very few novels are. It's a twisted, twisted book. It's a crazy book. A lot of my readers, that's their favorite book.
Well,
I'm always like, I can't repeat that. You know, I can't. I can't reach that level of nuttiness again. I just can't.
Well, it is a very strange book. And the only reason I read it, well, because I come from Michigan, and we went to Wisconsin a lot, and it was set in Wisconsin. And Civil War in Wisconsin, the idea of a Civil War thing in Wisconsin, you know, that period, wasn't very, it was unusual.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I read a lot of Civil War books set in the South, you know, or, you know, Washington, D.C., but I had never seen one before set in Wisconsin. So I thought it was fascinating.
Well, also, I mean, we've had a lot of books about soldiers who come home from war, but we've only had that since the end of World War I. There are very few books about people coming home from the Civil War. I mean, I think of, say, Cold Mountain. Comes to mind, but that's only very, very recently. So the veterans' experience after the Civil War, I think, would be especially fraught, I guess, or difficult. You know, coming back to your small town, especially if you're, you know, far north, because they didn't experience any of the war there. So it's very hard for them to relate. But yeah, very, very strange book. But I liked it. That is what I like to do. I guess that's my usual thing is to hop around. It's rare that I revisit a subject at all. So when I went back to Emily, it was a very strange experience. And to revisit Emily again with Henry himself, also very odd, because I'm used to these very far-flung things. The book that came out before Henry came out was City of Secrets, which is set in Jerusalem in 1946. It involves a survivor of the concentration camps in his involvement in the Jewish struggle against the British Mandate. So it's a book about revolution. It's a book about, you know, intrigue and secrets and romance. It's very sort of noir. It has a very strange setting. So, I don't know. It's what I like to do. I like to bounce around.
Well, and
But for certain authors, you know, I would never ask, say, Alice Munro to do, like, a, you know, horror novel.
Well,
you know, imagine, right? I want her to keep writing about, you know, that small town in Ontario or her experiences in Vancouver, you know, as a young wife, or, you know, I want them to do this. Sometimes people take a chance. Like, Updike would often write a novel that was just very far away from what he was usually doing, and it wouldn't turn out well. So,
but you live and learn.
Great, it's great as long as it's good. It's great to take a chance.
Exactly.
But, you know, but, you know, like I said before, they're not all going to be good. You know, and you can't expect them all to be good. You try your very best. You stick as close as you can to the character and understand that world. Try to bring it across. Sometimes it works. Sometimes you get lucky. You know, and other times it just doesn't work. And you hope that you know are in a position to not publish those.
Well, you have done, I think, a tremendous job with all of your books. And again, I want to tell people that the ideal book really here for Father's Day and Henry himself. You have a webpage that you want people to go to?
www.stuart-onan.com.
Okay,
I think I'm on Facebook as well. Just punch my name in and you'll find me.
Yeah, and make sure that when you do it, it's with a hyphen. Okay, Stuart-Onan. Okay, Stuart, well, thank you so much for joining me today on Joy on Paper. It's been a joy to talk to you. And I hope that next time when you're down here at Eckerd College, you'll come over to the studio and do another hour with me, okay?
Oh, I would love to. And I'd like to, as a final parting shot, please, everybody out there, support your local public library. Support them with your time, volunteering, with your money in donating, and with your books, because most of them will have a Friends of the Library book sale where they can turn that book around and bring you more books in the future. Support your public library.
Absolutely. That's great advice for everyone. Again, Stuart, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thanks, Patsy.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Oh, wow. That's fun. You have to get this book. When I was buying this book, I could have bought it on Kindle. And in a way, at first I was thinking, well, I'm going to get it on Kindle. But then I realized, I love the cover. It is such a lovely, it's a charming cover. It's the kind of book that you just want to put on your table and look at it every once in a while and admire it. It's just one of those books that you look at it, you say, I want to pick it up again and reread. As I said, he's got short chapters, and you can go back and read your favorite, and I'm sure that all of you will enjoy it. Again, it's a Father's Day gift if you're looking for one, and I think that you will all enjoy it. Also, please go to my webpage, radio-joyonpaper.com, and I have many of my interviews up there, and I'm loading up more. It takes a lot of time, but I'm trying to do them as fast as I can, and I appreciate all of your emails. I want to particularly thank everybody for emails asking more about my trip to New York. I will be posting. I'm going to work on a blog post about that so that I can tell you more about that and also about some of my upcoming guests. On Tuesday, I have Rachel Renee Russell, and we're going to be talking about, she's the author of Dork Diaries, and she's just such a delightful woman, and I've had her on the program before, and I always love to talk to her because she's so clever, and I love her books. Again, she writes books that really encourage young people to read. And if you are looking for a summer book for children, you can get all of her books. She has an entire series there, and it's just wonderful. I'm so excited that she's going to be joining me on Tuesday. And we're also going to have a D-Day. We're going to be talking about D-Day on Tuesday. We're going to play some special promos for D-Day, and we're also going to play Jim Lamb's beautiful poem that he wrote about Robin Olds, one of the heroes of World War II, and so I'm looking forward to hearing that poem again, and thank you, Jim, for giving it to me to have us read it here on Joy on Paper. Anyway, everybody, remember one of the things I say all the time is one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're really lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a streaming video, a film, or maybe a television series. You never know, but you have to start. And Stuart Onan has one advice he gives to all of his students and to all listeners, a page a day, a page a day. Get working and say something nice to somebody, and I'll say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. And he's saluting me. I'm saluting him. And bye-bye, everybody.